Here's a simplified timeline of a particularly achy episode in modern Korean history, the May 18th Gwangju Democratization Movement and Massacre. Until recently, maybe this timeline would have been openly questioned, but these days, certainly the weight of evidence is shifting in terms of a general consensus in favor of the victims of this particular, as I say, episode, we might describe it. On October 26, 1979, President Park Chung-hee was assassinated. There was a military coup led by then-General Chun Doo-hwan. On December 12th, the military regime declared martial law. That understandably provoked protests. And a military junta sent troops to Gwangju, with the city becoming a scapegoat. What followed was a 10-day-long uprising and massacre between May 18th and 28th of 1980. You may have seen what happened next in the film Taxi Driver. Armed forces attacking students with clubs, open fire, mobilizing tanks and helicopters against civilians. I mean, some of this is captured in real-life photographs as well that you can easily find online and elsewhere. The main character of that film I just referred to, you may remember telling his daughter on the phone, "Daddy has left a customer there, so I must return," and then went back into the turmoiled city. 38 years on, still, in spite of the clarity that I've just described, there is still truth and justice left behind. Tim Shorrock is investigative journalist who's done extensive work to unearth the truth of the Gwangju uprising, joins us on the line. Thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you.
And obviously it's very challenging to provide any kind of overview, but for many people who might be new to this country or have overlooked this part of history, it is important, isn't it, to get the facts right?
Oh, absolutely, because the facts were distorted for many years, and it took, 20, 30 years to really put the story together in South Korea and outside of Korea because of the controls that were imposed on the press at the time.
Was it the case that people wouldn't have wanted to believe that the official regime would have been capable of something like this? Do you have that sense?
Well, I think, part of what happened in Gwangju was that people of Gwangju themselves couldn't believe what they were seeing before their eyes. I mean, this was a very unusual, it hadn't happened for a long time, put it that way, in post-Korean War. And, this vicious attack that was just suddenly, a vicious attack on these young students who were demonstrating for the first day outside of Chunnam University, and then the way that the paratroopers just went in and started, chasing people into their homes and neighborhoods and beating them and stabbing them and bayoneting and dragging them into the streets just stunned people, I think. And people were, horrified and amazed, just surprised to see this happen. And so I think, it was just horrific. And I think the feeling was of shock at first.
You have compared this uprising, this whole situation, to other Cold War era events like China's 1989 Tiananmen Square or Hungary's 1956 revolt against the Soviet Union. But you have complained that Gwangju's not received the attention it deserves. Can you elaborate, please, for us?
Well, when people do talk about Cold War and they talk about, revolts that may have happened against ruling powers at that time, usually people will remember the Soviet repression in Hungary or the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia later on. But the crackdown in Hungary is often seen, that was a big revolt against the communist regime, and the U.S., supported the people in the streets, and that got a lot of attention at the time. But Gwangju kind of happened in a period, it was kind of before, of course, before the internet, and of course before social media, anything like that, and media was, it was easy to control the flow of information at that time, especially in Korea, under a martial law regime. And so the information took a long time to get out, as I said before, but even after it happened, it didn't get the attention it should have, because it happened in a country that was that had a government that was supported by the United States for national security reasons. And you know, let me just give you an example of the little lack of attention it received in terms of the media here in the United States. You know, when my stories came out in 1996, that showed extensive data information on the previously hidden role of the United States government in supporting the South Korean military's desire to have a sort of military clampdown on the demonstrations that were sweeping throughout South Korea in the spring of 1980. I mean, the U.S. basically told the South Korean government that it would understand why military troops might need to be used to replace the police. And of course, they cautioned against excessive violence, but you know, they basically gave them a green light to use military force instead of police on demonstrations, which were really peaceful, actually, demonstrations, if anyone who was there remembers them at the time, involved massive numbers of people. Mm. But when my documents came out that showed that, you know, the U.S. also knew about deployment of special forces and knew a lot more about what was going on in terms of the military crackdown, and this, my documents came out, the New York Times, which had a bureau chief named Nick Kristof, who had won a Pulitzer, who won a Pulitzer for covering the Tiananmen Square riots, the Tiananmen Square massacre. He did not even bother to cover these new documents and this new story about what had happened in South Korea. And I think that's because of Cold War blinders that many American reporters have.
Yeah.
It's a revolt in an American sort of, American-supported country. We don't take it as seriously as when it's in a country like China that has a communist government that we're supposedly against, you know. So it's that there's the politics play into the coverage. But, I mean, there were some very brave American reporters there. There was a German photographer that you mentioned who, thank God, was there in the early days to get his images out. And then after he was there, there was other reporters that got into the city. One in particular, Norman Thorpe, who was with the Wall Street Journal, got in and did some incredible stories. And there was other newspaper people were also there. And there was a few Japanese reporters there, too. And, so they did get the word out.
Yeah. I mean,
in terms of comparing to other revolts, I think Gwangju was missed because of the significance that was passed over because of the Cold War. And, Jimmy Carter's the president at the time, when he was asked about the issue of human rights, he actually said, well, human rights don't figure in when there's a communist revolt. He actually called it, a communist revolt, which it was not.
I mean, it is in some ways relatively recent in a timeline of modern history, but when you look at those images, it also seems so long ago that even just looking at the clothes that people are wearing, it's reflective, I think, of just how rapidly South Korea has changed since then. I just want to ask, and so for that reason alone, it's worth people checking these out. Strongly recommend it. But I want to ask you as well about what's left to be told from this story.
Mm-hmm.
What do you suspect, or what do you believe is still there to be uncovered?
Well, a lot has been dug up, obviously. In the last couple of weeks, and, as your listeners know, last May, when President Moon Jae-in spoke at the Gwangju Cemetery on 518, he directed the government and the Department of Defense there to start an investigation into who was responsible for shooting civilians and who was responsible for helicopters shooting at buildings. And over the last year, there was an investigation, and they did come out and conclude that, in fact, helicopters had been sent and so on. And so that a lot has come out even in the last couple of years. But it's still unclear to me and to other people who have been digging into it what exactly the U.S. knew about those helicopter shootings and what the U.S. role was in terms of, alerting Washington, the U.S. military there, alerting Washington on what the sort of overreaction of the Korean military. And I think there's still maybe some documentation about, you know, what was said between U.S. generals and Korean generals. That kind of information is still not, you know, it's still not come out.
Yeah. Well, and Defense Minister Song Young-mu, because we're short of time, I just want to address this. He directly said, we will delve... He said this in the last few days. We will delve into the truth behind any controversies over the uprising, including the helicopter attack on civilians, and also sex issues, reported mass rapes committed by military soldiers.
You know, I did not know about that until you told about it. I knew people were abused there, but I did not know about that. You know, but it's, you know, when you talked about the pictures, and I actually, before you called, I was looking through these images that had been given to me by the 518 Memorial Foundation photographers who were there. And it is a different time, you know, but the thing is that so many people came out in that city. It was just such a massive outpouring of people of all, you know, ages and men and women and kids and, you know, older people, students, professors. You know, everybody was out there. And that's what's, you know, that's what's really missing, I think, from the stories about it. You know, it wasn't just a, you know, young band or small band of rebels.
No.
You know, it was a whole city that really rose up.
Yeah, well, we can imagine, I think, based on what's happened in the last year, we can sort of draw a mental picture of what that would have been like. And if there was anything untoward happening beyond even the military actions, as in the sexual abuse of those ordinary people, it goes further beyond the pale. Tim Shorrock, investigative journalist, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you very much for calling me.